I was convinced that when I wasn't looking at them, these cells became something else, that the very act of observation changed everything. I knew this was madness, and yet still I thought it. I felt as if Area X were laughing at me then. Every blade of grass, every stray insect, every drop of water. What would happen when the crawler reached the bottom of the tower? What would happen when it came back up? Then I examined the samples from the village. Moss from the forehead of one of the eruptions, splinters of wood, a dead fox, a rat. The wood was indeed wood. The rat was indeed a rat. The moss and the fox were composed of modified human cells. Where lies the strangling fruit that came from the hand of the sinner? I shall bring forth the seeds of the dead. I suppose I should have reared back from the microscope in shock, but I was beyond such reactions to anything that instrument might show me. Instead, I contented myself with quiet cursing. The boar on the way to base camp, the strange dolphins, the tormented beast in the reeds. Even the idea that replicas of members of the 11th expedition had crossed back over all supported the evidence of my microscope. Transformations were taking place here, and as much as I had felt part of a natural landscape on my trek to the lighthouse, I could not deny that these habitats were transitional in a deeply unnatural way. A perverse sense of relief overtook me. At least now I had proof of something strange happening, along with the brain tissue the anthropologist had taken from the skin of the crawler. By then, though, I had enough of samples. I ate lunch and decided against putting more effort into cleaning up the camp. Most of that task would have to fall to the next expedition. It was another brilliant, blinding afternoon of stunning blue sky, allied with a comfortable heat. I sat for a time, watched the dragonflies skimming the long grass, the dipping, looping flight of a red-headed woodpecker. I was just putting off the inevitable, my return to the tower, and yet still I wasted time. When I finally picked up my husband's journal and started to read, the brightness washed over me in unending waves and connected me to the earth, the water, the trees, the air, as I opened up and kept on opening. Nothing about my husband's journal was expected, except for some terse, hastily scribbled exceptions. He had addressed most of the entries to me. I did not want this, and as soon as it became apparent, I had to resist the need to throw the journal away from me as if it were poison. My reaction had nothing to do with love or lack of love, but was more out of the sense of guilt. He had meant to share this journal with me, and now he was either truly dead or existed in a state beyond any possible way for me to communicate with him, to reciprocate. The 11th expedition had consisted of 8 members, all male, a psychologist, 2 medics, including my husband, a linguist, a surveyor, a biologist, an anthropologist, and an archaeologist. They had come to Area X in the winter, when the trees had lost most of their leaves and the reeds had turned darker and thicker. The flowering bushes became sullen and seemed to huddle along the path, as he put it. Fewer birds than indicated in reports, he wrote, but where do they go? Only the ghost bird knows. The sky frequently clouded over, and the water level in the cypress swamps was low. No rain the entire time we've been here, he wrote at the end of the first week. They, too, discovered what only I call the tower on their 5th or 6th day. I was ever more certain that the location of the base camp had been chosen to trigger that discovery, but their surveyor's opinion that they must continue mapping the wider area meant they followed a different course than ours. None of us were eager to climb down in there, my husband wrote. Me least of all. My husband had claustrophobia, sometimes even had to leave our bed in the middle of the night to go sleep on the deck. For whatever reason, the psychologist did not in this case coerce the expedition to go down into the tower. They explored farther, past the ruined village, to the lighthouse and beyond. Of the lighthouse, my husband noted their horror at discovering the signs of carnage, but of being too respectful of the dead to put things right, by which I suppose he meant the overturned tables on the ground level. He did not mention the photograph of the lighthouse keeper on the wall of the landing, which disappointed me. Like me, they had discovered the pile of journals at the top of the lighthouse, been shaken by it. We had an intense argument about what to do. I wanted to abort the mission and return home because clearly we'd been lied to. But it was at this point that the psychologist apparently re-established control, if of a tenuous sort. One of the directives from Area X was for each expedition to remain a unit. But in the very next entry, the expedition had decided to split up, as if to salvage the mission by catering solely to each person's will, and thus ensuring that no one would try to return to the border. The other medic, the anthropologist, the archaeologist, and the psychologist stayed in the lighthouse to read the journals and investigate the area around the lighthouse. The linguist and the biologist went back to explore the tower. My husband and the surveyor continued on past the lighthouse. "You would love it here," he wrote in a particularly manic entry that suggested to me not so much optimism as an unsettling euphoria. "You would love the light on the dunes. You would love the sheer expansive wildness of it." They wandered up the coast for an entire week, mapping the landscape and fully expecting at some point to encounter the border, whatever form it might take, some obstacle that barred their progress. But they never did. Instead, the same habitat confronted them day after day. "We're heading north, I believe," he wrote, "but even though we cover a good 15 to 20 miles by nightfall, nothing has changed. It's all the same." Although he also was quite emphatic that he did not mean they were somehow caught in a strange recurring loop. Yet he knew that, by all rights, we should have encountered the border by now. Indeed, they were well into an expanse of what he called the Southern Reach that had not yet been charted. That we had been encouraged by the vagueness of our superiors to assume existed back beyond the border. I too knew that Area X ended abruptly, not far past the lighthouse. How did I know this? Our superiors had told us during training, so in fact, I knew nothing at all. They turned back finally because behind us we saw strange cascading lights far distant, and from the interior more lights and sounds that we could not identify. We became concerned for the expedition members we had left behind. At the point when they turned back, they had come within sight of a rocky island, the first island we have seen, which they felt a powerful urge to explore, although there was no easy way to get over to it. The island appeared to have been inhabited at one time. We saw stone houses dotting a hill and a dock below. The return trip to the lighthouse took 4 days, not 7, as if the land had contracted. At the lighthouse, they found the psychologist gone and the bloody aftermath of a shootout on the landing halfway up. A dying survivor, the archaeologist, told us that something not of the world had come up the stairs and that it had killed the psychologist and then withdrawn with his body. But the psychologist came back later, the archaeologist raved. There were only 2 bodies, and neither was the psychologist. He could not account for the absence. He also could not tell us why they had shot each other, except to say, "We did not trust ourselves," over and over again. My husband noted that some of the wounds I saw were not from bullets, and even the blood spatter on the walls did not correspond to what I knew of crime scenes. There was a strange residue on the floor. The archaeologist propped himself up in the corner of the landing and threatened to shoot us if we came close enough to see his wounds. Soon enough, though, he was dead. Afterward, they dragged the bodies from the landing and buried them high up on the beach, a little distance from the lighthouse. It was difficult, Ghost Bird, and I don't know that we ever really recovered. Not really. This left the linguist and the biologist at the tower. The surveyor suggested either going back up the coast past the lighthouse or following the beach down the coast. But we both knew this was just an avoidance of the facts. What he was really saying was that we should abandon the mission, that we should lose ourselves in the landscape. That landscape was impinging on them now. The temperature dipped and rose violently. There were rumblings deep underground that manifested as slight tremors. The sun came to them with a greenish tinge, as if somehow the border were distorting our vision. They also saw flocks of birds headed inland, not of the same species, but hawks and ducks, herons and eagles, all grouped together as if in common cause. At the tower, they ventured only a few levels down before coming back up. I noticed no mention of words on the wall. If the linguist and the biologist were inside, they were much farther down, but we had no interest in following them. They returned to base camp, only to find the body of the biologist stabbed several times. The linguist had left a note that read simply, "Went to the tunnel. Do not look for me." I felt a strange pang of sympathy for a fallen colleague. No doubt the biologist had tried to reason with the linguist, or so I told myself. Perhaps he had tried to kill the linguist, but the linguist had clearly already been ensnared by the tower, by the words of the crawler. Knowing the meaning of the words on such intimate terms might have been too much for anyone, I realize now. The surveyor and my husband returned to the tower at dusk. Why is not apparent from the journal entries. There began to be breaks that corresponded to the passage of some hours, with no recap. But during the night, they saw a ghastly procession heading into the tower. 7 of the 8 members of the 11th expedition, including a doppelganger of my husband and the surveyor. And there before me, myself, I walked so stiffly. I had such a blank look on my face. It was so clearly not me, and yet it was me. A kind of shock froze both me and the surveyor. We did not try to stop them. Somehow it seemed impossible to try to stop ourselves, and I won't lie, we were terrified. We could do nothing but watch until they had descended. For a moment afterward, it all made sense to me, everything that had happened. We were dead. We were ghosts roaming a haunted landscape, and although we didn't know it, people lived normal lives here. Everything was as it should be here. But we couldn't see it through the veil, the interference. Slowly my husband shook off this feeling. They waited hidden in the trees behind the tower for several hours to see if the doppelgangers would return. They argued about what they would do if that happened. The surveyor wanted to kill them. My husband wanted to interrogate them. In their residual shock, neither of them made much of the fact that the psychologist was not among their number. At one point, a sound like hissing steam emanated from the tower and a beam of light shot out into the sky, then abruptly cut off, but still no one emerged, and eventually the two men returned to base camp. It was at this point that they decided to go their separate ways. The surveyor had seen all he cared to see and planned to return down the trail from base camp to the border immediately. My husband refused because he suspected from some of the readings in the journal that the idea of return through the same means as our entry might in fact be a trap. My husband had, over the course of time, having encountered no obstacle to travel farther north, grown suspicious of the entire idea of borders, although he could not yet synthesize the intensity of this feeling into a coherent theory.